You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, not everybody believes in the American way. See, I mean, you've got capitalism, and then you've got vulture capitalism. And Mitch McConnell and the Republicans have finally found their voice. Here's the bottom line on this. The president and his campaign, the re-elect President Obama campaign, came out a couple of days ago with an ad that, in fact, it was last week, that featured people at a steel mill that had been not just laid off, fired, lost their pensions, lost their health care, devastated the community. All the stores that these people went to buy things went out of business. The local, I mean, it's just Mitt Romney's company, Bain Capital, just wiped out this little steel company. It wasn't so little. It had a couple hundred employees. And it wasn't so little. Mitt Romney himself and his buddies, the vulture capitalists, that, you know, they made millions off this thing. It was a pump and dump operation. You know, buy the thing, load it up with debt, squeeze every last penny out of it, steal workers' pensions, and then throw it into bankruptcy. And then even the suppliers get screwed. Everybody gets screwed except Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. That's how private equity works. Private equity is not capitalism. Private equity is not even related to capitalism. Capitalism is where a capitalist, in other words, a person with capital. Capital is a fancy word for cash. Now, you know, in the more esoteric forms, I suppose capital can stand for other things of value, other kinds of assets. But typically, capital means you got cash. And the way capitalism works is not A, what private equity is, or B, what most Americans think it is. And this is the thing that is so astounding to me, is the economic illiteracy of Americans being preyed upon by the Romney-level rich, and particularly the vulture capitalists in the private equity business, formerly known as the leveraged buyout business. Just consider this. Here's how capitalism works. Just good old-fashioned, generic, plain vanilla capitalism. Thomas Edison invents something really cool, and he doesn't have the money to bring it to the market. So he goes and he finds a couple of people who will put some money into a new business called Edison Electric. And in exchange for the money that they put in, they get stock in his company. So he no longer owns his entire invention. He owns, you know, a piece of it, but he doesn't own the whole thing because he sold pieces of it, stock in the company, to venture capitalists. They brought the capital to the table. Then with that money, Thomas Edison or the guy that he or the woman that he hires to manage his company. And I'm using this as an example because it's a real story. I mean, this is how Edison got in. You know, he had no money. He was a poor kid. So you bring in investors. They end up owning part of your company. They are the capitalist. Edison was not the capitalist. He was the inventor. And the capitalists bring capital to the table, and they make their money by just sitting back and waiting while the business person, the entrepreneur, the inventor, works his or her butt off building a successful business using the money that the capitalists put in. And when that business reaches a certain size, you sell the business or take the business public, and you get your payday. And so do the capitalists. Most recent example of this is Facebook. Now, it looks like there was some sneaky deals going on with Facebook and the banksters and all this kind of stuff. There's lawsuits flying around. Facebook's stock fell. But the bottom line is that back when Mark Zuckerberg was hatching his scheme to create Facebook, and he was doing this out of his dorm room at Harvard, One of his roommates was from a wealthy Brazilian family that Zuckerberg actually thought was connected, or apparently, according to the story, thought was connected to the mafia, the Brazilian mafia. And who knows, maybe he was. But anyhow, he came from a wealthy family in Brazil. And Zuckerberg said, you know, we need some money to make this thing happen because it was going really, really well at Harvard. And they extended it to a couple of other colleges. And everybody thought, wow, this is really cool. So let's take it to the public. Well, it's going to take $15,000. We've got to buy server space that's, you know, fast enough and big enough that we can propagate this thing out. And this guy who put in $15,000, he's the guy who, you know, gave up his U.S. citizenship to move to Singapore, although he did that some time ago. Apparently, he was never really all that interested in being an American. Keep in mind, he was a Brazilian when he came here. But in any case, he was the capitalist. He put up $15,000, and when Facebook went public, he cashed that stock in that he bought for $15,000 for $3 billion. There were a few other investors who came along after him as the company grew, and they put in some money, too, to help grow the company. They were capitalists. That's venture capitalism. That is not... That's not how Mitt Romney got rich. Now, Bain Capital did do a couple of those kinds of deals where they joined with, you know, in the case of the steel company that Mitt Romney's running ads for right now. Mitt Romney was the smallest of eight investors who came in, or Bain Capital, rather, was the smallest of eight investors who came in. So Bain did a little bit of venture capital, but mostly what they did was leveraged buyouts, now known as private equity. Which is you buy a company, you load it with debt. Its debt payments now are tax deductible, so even if it's not profitable, it's starting to show a profit on paper. You squeeze that company as hard as you can, get the employees to take pension cuts, strip them of their health care benefits, cut their wages. If there's a union, bust up the union, send the jobs offshore if you possibly can. Do anything you can to increase the profitability, to hell with the consequences to the community or the human beings involved. And then once the company is stable, you sell it off. And no matter what you sell it for, you take 20% off the top. That's Bain's model. That's called private equity. It's not capitalism. But the Republicans are going hysterical. Here's clip number three. Here's Bill O'Reilly talking about this. Maybe. Okay, here we go.
I don't believe that this is a winner for President Obama to attack capitalism through Mitt Romney's performance at Bain. Wall Street Journal's all over him, and that's the most widely read newspaper in the country. It just looks like it reinforces some people's belief that the president is a socialist.
Oh, yeah. First of all, plug the Wall Street Journal, because that's also owned by Rupert Murdoch, your boss and taskmaster, Mr. O'Reilly. But secondly, there's no attack on capitalism here. There's an attack on vulture capitalism, which is private equity. And it's not even an attack on that. I suppose it's possible to do private equity in a way that doesn't destroy companies, although, frankly, I think it's fairly hard. Clip number four here is Fox's Stuart Varney basically saying, you know, Fox has this whole thing lined up now. Here's Fox's Stuart Varney.
Why would they attack capitalism? As you said, America is a free enterprise country, always has been. That is the American tradition. But capitalism seems to be attacked by the president and some people in the House.
And again, here, clip number five, this is Fox's John Scott. You know, I'm sorry, this is not about capitalism. No. But that, in any case, you get it. This is, well, actually, clip number seven, Fox's Eric Bowling.
And I think President Obama's really, he's raping the American taxpayer, and he's not even giving us a dinner or a glass of wine, a cocktail.
Aha. Oh, that was in response to Congressman Clyburn. We'll be back with more about this, but this, the bottom line here is, A, what Romney does isn't capitalism, by and large. What Romney does is vulture capitalism, and B, will the Republicans get away with trying to characterize what Romney does or did as capitalism?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, the Republicans are basically, and Fox News, are basically doubling down on the bet that the American people are dumb, that they're economic illiterates. You think it's true? So is Bain... really worth talking about? Paul Krugman thinks so. In fact, he's pretty sure that Bain is worth talking about. And he wants to tell us about that. Here he is.
The whole premise, if there's any case for making, you know, Mitt Romney was a one-term governor of Massachusetts. Why should he be president? And his answer is, I'm a businessman. I know how to run things. I know how to run this economy. So his business career is perfectly fair game. It is totally worth pointing out that, yes, he made a lot of money. He made a lot of money in ways that were often not good for workers. That's certainly worth talking about. And it's also totally important to point out, as President Obama just did, that what a president needs to do is not what you need to do if you're trying to make a bunch of money for private equity investors.
So another really important point here, which takes me back to George Bush and Dick Cheney. Remember 2001? George W. Bush was elected by virtue of the Supreme Court stopping the vote count down in Florida. First, his brother had Catherine Harris push 50, 60, 70, 80,000, depends on whose numbers you're looking at. Nobody's disputing the number that it was, you know, fewer than 50,000 African Americans off the voting rolls. People who were actually legal citizens, fully eligible to vote, knocked them off the voting rolls because their names resembled, not were exactly the same as, but resembled the names of African Americans in Texas who were felons. So first of all, they knock 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls when the first African American in history is running for president. Down in Florida, they did this. And then George Bush arguably wins by about 500 votes, 537 as I recall. And the state Supreme Court says, we're going to recount the entire state. Now, a year later, and you can read this in the New York Times archives, it's from late September of 2001. A year later, a consortium of news agencies, the USA Today, the New York Times, the Associated Press, there was a couple of others, actually took all those ballots and hand-counted them. And as they point out in the New York Times, by any measure, dimple chads, pimple chads, pregnant chads, hanging chads, dangling chads, no chads, intent of voter, not intent of voter, you know, hysterical voter, whatever it may be, by any measure, Al Gore won Florida. Right there. But Bush had the Supreme Court. He had John Roberts, who used to clerk for Chief Justice Rehnquist. He went down to Florida. He trained Bush's legal team in how to argue before Rehnquist. And, of course, he was rewarded for that by George Bush making him the grand poobah, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. So anyhow, George W. Bush gets selected by the Supreme Court because what the Supreme Court said was to the Florida State Supreme Court, which, by the way, is unconstitutional. There's this thing called states' rights, the 10th Amendment, 9th and 10th Amendments. They said to the state of Florida, you can't recount those ballots. Which, of course, and the reason why, by the way, go back and read Bush v. Gore. Read the ruling. The reason you can't recount those ballots is because it will cause irreparable harm to plaintiff George W. Bush. Verbatim quote from the decision. In other words, if you recount the ballots, everybody's going to know that Al Gore won. So, anyhow, is this about private equity? Well, back to 2000, 2001. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney come into office, illegitimately, in my opinion. And what's the first thing they say? We've both got masters in business administration. We've both got MBAs. We're going to run this country like a company. And then what do? George Bush then proceeded. He started out by saying that, you know, he was going to pay off all the debt. Remember, we had that clip yesterday. I don't know if you guys still have it convenient. If you don't, you know, let me know right now if you do. No, you don't. Okay. George Bush, in his State of the Union address yesterday, said, I'm going to pay off all the debt. We're going to pay off literally all of the debt within 10 years. That would have been as of last year. But then he started to run the country like a company, like the way Bain Financial would run a company. He loaded us up with trillions of dollars worth of debt. He fought two wars, $1 trillion each, that were not paid for, put them on the nation's credit card. He passed out prescription drugs to seniors and put it on the credit card, and to make it even worse, as a $300 billion gift to Big Pharma told the Medicare administration, you may not negotiate with the drug companies. You have to pay full retail. $5 a piece for aspirins, right? And then he added another $2 trillion to our debt by pushing through a massive tax cut for people like Mitt Romney, for millionaires and billionaires. So we tried this in 2000, having a couple guys whose whole claim to fame was, hey, I'm a businessman. George W. Bush, I used to run our Busto Oil down in Texas before it went broke. By the way, read George W. Bush's Wikipedia page. You won't find any of this stuff. It has been so scrubbed by the right-wingers. It is amazing. You won't find that he was bailed out by Osama bin Laden's half-brother, who then died in a plane crash in Texas. When people were looking into it, you won't find the details of his insider trading deal, of his sweetheart deal on the stadium. $800,000 investment, makes $14 million, as I recall, in profit. You know, none of that stuff. In any case, George W. Bush, a failed businessman. Dick Cheney, who had been running Halliburton, which was illegally selling drilling equipment and aluminum tubes to Iran in violation of an embargo. This is why I keep saying I think Ahmadinejad is funding the Republicans. Right? Reagan sold weapons to Iran illegally. Cheney sold stuff to Iran that they could use to make nuclear centrifuges illegally. You know, they want another Republican. So anyhow, we tried this before. We tried having a Republican president who says, yeah, I'm a businessman and so is my vice president, and we're going to run this country like a business. And they ran it just like Bain Capital. Run up an enormous amount of debt, squeeze out as much profit as you can, let your buddies all get incredibly rich, which happened during the Bush era. The rich got incredibly richer, and screw the workers. Sound familiar?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the question again, and I'll pick up your calls right after this, will the American people buy this stuff that Fox News is peddling, that this is capitalism? Welcome back. Excuse me. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is really pretty amazing. Paul in Fairland, Oklahoma. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, Tom, good show.
Thank you.
Hey, you know, President Obama, he's not attacking capitalism. He's attacking the bill about the jobs. And if you want to stop and think, you know, Romney talks about staples, non-union. All the jobs that were lost were union jobs. Everything that comes out of that man's mouth is break unions. Let the auto industry go down. Get rid of union contracts. Get rid of pensions. That's what he's all about.
Yep. Here's
another thing. You know, just like this Tea Party, you know, they're so patriotic, you know, democracy, freedom. Look what's going on up in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the Democrats destroying freedoms. It's the Republicans. Anti-gay bills, anti-union bills, anti-woman bills. It's just on and on. They want us to go. They want to, you know, I'm sure this is all about jobs. Because they want to take control of the job after they tank the economy, and then they'll have people begging for jobs. Oh, yeah. We'll give them to you.
Turn us
work for Chinese wages.
Yeah, turn us into Pinochet's Chile. And to a certain extent, that's already happening. And thanks for the call, Paul. We're hearing that there are companies, big companies, that are bringing jobs back to America. Why? Because 20 years ago, those jobs paid $30, $40 an hour. They were good manufacturing jobs. Now they're reinventing them at $10 an hour. The median income in the United States, $26,200 a year. Now, you tell me how anybody can raise a family on that. Joe in Niagara Falls, New York. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the private equity. It's not just private equity anymore. It's the financialization of the whole economy.
Yep.
Because if you go and you do your telephone, your internet, and your cable all in one package, you get that deal for the first year. And then the bill nearly doubles the next year. And it's all because they get to play those on the backside of the market and those CDOs and the derivatives.
Yep.
That's all it is. It's creating money on the backside and people claiming it for themselves that are part
right.
of the
world. That might have just flown right over people's heads. Here's how it works. When a phone company or a cable company sells you a package and you get the $39.95 special that's going to become $139 a year down the road, but you've signed a two-year contract, they can book that as a long-term asset because at the $139, you know, with the total amount of revenue that you've got that you're going to eventually have to pay, even though you think you just got a great deal for the first couple months, you have, in many cases, you know, there's very little disclosure about what you're eventually going to pay. And then once they've booked that, that becomes basically a debt to the company that they can then create derivatives based on, or they can sell, they, you know, their bank can sell derivatives based on, and then other people can make derivatives out of those derivatives, and people can make derivatives out of those derivatives, and it becomes this giant betting parlor. You're absolutely right, Joe.
It's a Ponzi scheme on the backside of things. And the only contracts that the Republicans do not want to honor nowadays are labor contracts.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Any other contract is gold. Listen to how they complained about the contracts and the bondholders for GM when GM was going down.
Yeah. Well, those were the investors. That was the investor class. We can't harm the investor class. Those job creators might get upset and not create jobs or something like that.
But
Joe, well said.
Proven they're not creating the jobs. They're keeping the money in their pocket.
Yeah, or putting it like Romney did in his Swiss bank account or his Cayman Islands bank account. Absolutely. Joe, thank you. Mark in Eureka, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I got two things to say. I watched a program a couple weeks ago on TED Talks, and I believe it was on, I'm not sure what station it was on, but this guy, well, they refused to actually put it on the air, and his name was Nick Hauner, H-A-N-A-U-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a venture capitalist, and he explained that the real wealth of the economy comes from us, the
right.
people.
It comes from the workers, not from the capitalists. Excellent point, Mark, and you're absolutely right about that TED Talk, and well said. Bill in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, I'm just sitting here thanking my lucky stars I'm not a woman or a minority because I'm in Arizona. But
really?
Now, all right, I'm just a fat kid with an eighth grade education, so a lot of this stuff goes over my head, but I want to tell you what I've gathered from listening to you.
Okay.
Private equity, basically, you're saying, is a small group of people take somebody else's money, they buy a company, break it down, either bankrupt it or sell it for a profit because they make it look profitable.
Right.
Am I basically right?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a small percentage of cases where they actually take a company that's poorly managed and manage it better and make it profitable. But that's really the rarity. Usually what they do is they look for companies that are capable of spinning off cash. In other words, companies that are already well run and doing just fine. Thank
right.
you.
Right. So I heard you saying all this, and it all sounded so familiar for me. I had to start taking notes and figure out where I'd heard it before.
Leveraged buyout arrests back in the 80s. They called them LBOs.
No, closer than that.
Okay.
Isn't that basically the Ryan budget plan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's do this to the federal government. Let's.
Yeah, that's if it's on a grander scale, but, you know, he wants to take away all of our benefits, all of our Social Security, Medicare.
Right. And give a $3 trillion tax cut to millionaires and billionaires and put up a missile defense shield on the East Coast so that his buddies in the defense industry can get an extra $1 trillion that the Pentagon doesn't even want. They're saying, you know, we've already got a missile defense, you know, shield. We've got planes, bombers and fighter jets in the air continuously. We've got missiles, all of it. We've got mutually assured destruction. We've got all these nukes. I mean, there's no need for and besides that, if the United States gets hit, it'll probably be like 9/11. It'll probably be some low-tech thing. Somebody smuggles, you know, a kilogram of radioactive material into a city and explodes it with dynamite to create a dirty bomb and render the city uninhabitable. Or, you know, the so-called dirty bomb scenario, or they set a building on fire. You know, who knows? But no country is going to commit suicide by launching missiles at the United States.
So that's why they think Mitt Romney needs to be the president, because he does have experience running a private equity firm, which is exactly what the Republican Party wants to be.
Excellent point.
A private equity firm.
Excellent point. Excellent, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call, Bill. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Two things. First of all, about the idea that people, they should run government like a business. It's the biggest. It's so ridiculous. A business is, they're fundamentally different concepts. A business doesn't run under democratic principles, but the government does, at
no.
least where this government is supposed to.
You're right. The businesses are kingdoms.
They're kingdoms, and to say we want to run the government like a business means we want to run government like a kingdom.
That's right.
But I wanted to pick up on Bush v. Gore. As I read it, there were two major pieces of, I guess, legislation or rules that were used. The first one was Section 3 of the U.S. Code, which I don't know what that says, but the other one was the 14th Amendment. And it said, at least as I understood it, that you have to stop counting or not count them, the votes, because there were so many different kinds of voting machines and voting methods in Florida that it would be unfair it wouldn't be protecting the equal rights of each voter in Florida to recount the votes of a different kind of machine
right.
in another county.
That was one of the arguments that was made by one of the lawyers who was trained by John Roberts, yes.
Right, and one of the things I thought about that was, well, then no recount is possible.
Well, not only is no recount possible, but then if you follow, you extend the logic of that, all elections in the United States are violations of the 14th Amendment because we don't have a uniform voting system across the country.
Exactly, and so then I thought also, then there's no repercussion for election fraud in this country.
Yeah.
There is no repercussions.
And no consequence for it.
No
yes.
consequences for election fraud.
Yeah.
So what's to stop any state from jacking their elections?
No.
I mean, and that's obviously why it happens so frequently.
Yep. I think you're absolutely right, and you totally nailed it. And Bush v. Gore is a fascinating read in American history, and particularly in how the Supreme, you know, they even said in Bush v. Gore, by the way, this case does not establish precedent. In other words, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Do not use this case. Do not quote this case in the future. And, of course, it's been quoted now several times. Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was sitting here listening to you explain what bank capital does and trying to think of an analogy that is more comprehensible to people who aren't economic nerds.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I thought, what if there was a branch of medicine who served clients with terminal diseases, and the first test they did was, can you pay for expensive continuing care to extend your life? And if the answer is no, they wheel them into the OR and harvest their organs and sell their organs so they make a profit.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what Mitt Romney was doing to these various companies.
Right.
There's no way we would tolerate that kind of
I don't
practice
think so.
In the medical profession. But for some reason, we have this class of people with money for whom there are no rules of ethical conduct. They have no, they don't have to answer to anybody for what they do.
That's because
so they
successfully
the
rewrote the rules. Pardon me? Oh, okay. Thank you very much, Virginia. Well said. I would say that's because they successfully rewrote the rules. I mean, you know, and that's what we need to know, is that private equity would not even be possible if it wasn't for a couple of major loopholes in the tax code that shouldn't even be there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And once again, for those who don't know, private equity, what Bain Capital did, is not capitalism. It's leveraged buyouts. It's the LBO business, renamed.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, got to go round.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff on Sirius, it says you disagree with me. What's up, Jeff?
Hi. I'd just like to make a couple of points. Private equity, venture capital, and leverage buyout. Those are three totally different venues.
Arguably, I would submit to you that private equity is the reinvention of LBOs. And in fact, if you Google it thoroughly enough, you will find quotes from the late 80s and early 90s where LBO artists were talking openly about how they needed to rebrand their industry because so many people had gone to jail, so many people had destroyed businesses, so many people had ruined lives that LBO had gotten a bad name. And that's why there's nobody in America right now who's waving their hand saying, I'm an LBO guy, because they decided to change their name to private equity.
Tom, I'm prefacing this by saying my son attended Wharton at University of Pennsylvania, then went to Harvard, then spent time in an investment banking company, and then spent 10 years in private equity.
You have my sympathy, sir. I'm sorry to hear.
That's like saying, you know, you pick up a handful of dirt and the farmer says it's gold and you put it in your wife's house on the white carpet and she says it's crap. But what I'm saying to you is there are huge differences between venture capital and private equity.
Please identify. Of course there are. I've been saying that from the get-go. Venture capital is good old-fashioned capitalism. That's where somebody comes in as an angel investor and says, here's $1 million. In exchange for that, give me 12% of the stock in this company. And the entrepreneur gives them a piece of the stock, and then they take that $1 million and they build their business. That's venture capital. That's good old-fashioned, all-American capitalism. It's how Thomas Edison built his business. It's how George Westinghouse built his business. It's how I've built, actually, one business, of the ones that I've started. It's how entrepreneurs historically built America. That's venture capitalism. Private equity is leveraged buyouts rebranded. And it is not that. Private equity is using somebody else's money not to have the company, not to run the company, but to buy the company and then saddling the company with that debt rather than you yourself having that debt. If I'm a venture capitalist and you're starting a business and you come to me and you say, hey, you know, I need $1 million to get this business off the ground. And I'm looking at it thinking, Jeff might have the next Microsoft. If I only had $1 million, but I'm a venture capitalist who only has $500,000. Okay. So, but you're coming to me and saying, I got $1 million. You know, if you give me $1 million, I'll make you as rich as Bill Gates. And I believe you. Then I might go to a bank and say, I got $500,000 I'm going to put into this company. And I got a house worth $500,000. Would you please loan me $500,000 against my house? And then I get that money from the bank and I go to you and I say, here's $1 million. Now make us both rich. I'm still a venture capitalist. Now, the difference between that and private equity or leveraged buyouts is that with a private equity deal or an LBO deal, I would go to the bank and I'd say, okay, I need $1 million to buy Jeff's company or to invest in Jeff's company. Only instead of just being an investor, like I just described, you know, ending up with 10, 15, 20% of the stock, I'm going to buy the whole damn thing. I would go to the bank and I would take that $500,000 and then I would say to you, Jeff, you now have to pay back the bank. I'm not going to pay back the bank. You pay back the bank. That's how private equity works.
Totally incorrect, Tom.
No, it's totally correct. It is absolutely totally correct that, in fact, here is Robert Reich, a professor of economics, an actual professor of economics, explaining it.
The magic of private equity in 8 simple steps. Step 1, partners in private equity firms don't risk their own money. They get other people to give them money to invest. Step 2, they use this money to buy up companies they think they can squeeze higher profits from. Step 3, they squeeze out higher profits by cutting the company's costs. And for most companies, the biggest cost is payrolls. So private equity managers typically reduce payrolls by firing workers and or cutting other workers' wages and their health and pension benefits. Step 4, they also use the company as collateral to borrow a pile of money from banks. And since interest payments on this debt are deductible from company income, presto, the company shows even bigger profits.
On paper.
They get the company to issue a special dividend to repay the original investors. So now everything else is gravy. Step 6, then they sell the company for much more than they bought it for because, hey, it's more profitable. Step 7, they pocket 20% of the gains from the sale. And finally, step 8, because the tax law treats these earnings as capital gains, they pay only a 15% tax on them.
See, it all works because, first of all, this is leveraged buyouts, revisited. And, you know, with all due respect to the man whose son went to Wharton Business School and is in the private equity business, this is how it works. And Robert Reich, professor of economics, former cabinet member, you know, Secretary of Labor in the United States, and the author of a brilliant new book that's out, you know, lays it out, number one. And number two, this is how it works. It's very simple. Private equity and leveraged buyouts, which are basically the same thing, are not venture capital. I don't know how to say it, you know, often enough. But it has to be said over and over again. John in San Luis Obispo, we have a minute to the end of this hour. John, what's up?
Yeah, this won't take long. I just got a quick bumper sticker and a not a great comparison about bank capital, but a comparison. Bumper sticker, I need Obamacare because the Republicans are making me sick.
Okay.
And the other one about bank capital, I kind of compare them to the old Western movies where a guy would ride into town, shoot up somebody, leave him for dead in the middle of nowhere, steal his gold fillings and take his wallet and say, you know what, I stole it fair and square.
Yeah, I'm a rich guy now.
I do.
I'm a rich guy now,
and I got it fair and square.
Yep, this is the exact opposite of Robin Hood. Mitt Romney is the antithesis of Robin Hood. And, you know, he's not stealing from the rich to give to the poor. He's stealing from the poor. Actually, he's stealing from working people who are working for the companies that he's pumping and dumping. He's stealing from them to make himself over $250 million. And he only pays 14% and change income tax on it. That's Mitt Romney.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, now as we continue on through the day, and through the week and through the month and all the way up until the presidential election, I'm sure, trying to explain to people that there's a difference between vulture capitalism, a.k.a. leveraged buyouts, a.k.a. private equity. In other words, how Mitt Romney got rich, not contributing anything to anything. And venture, good old-fashioned venture capitalism, angel investor, you know, American capital. There's a difference between these two things. We'll get back to more of that in just a few minutes, but there's also the issue of how do you play football if nobody builds a football field? Very simple question. David Harsanyi is with us. He's with HumanEvents.com, Human Events Online, senior reporter. David Walker, and a nationally syndicated columnist. David Walker for the program.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece saying J.P. Morgan proves we don't need more regulations. So let me just ask you this question. How can you play a football game if you don't have referees, goalposts, and rules?
Well, you have tons of rules, and you have referees already. I mean, I think my point is, the macro point is that we have to let people who take on risky investments, we have to let them pay the price for their risk, not either stop them, because risk is I think you'd agree, a healthy part of capitalism. Occasionally we lose and win. And that if we continue to inject moral hazard into markets in this way, we're going to either have a stale market, but more than that, we're going to let banks get away with stuff more and more because we have to save them every time.
David, that sounds like gibberish. My question was, two questions, actually. The first, again, you know, we're establishing the marketplace. We allow banks to exist. We define the rules by which banks exist. The banking industry wouldn't exist if government hadn't established it, number one. And number two, do you really want your bank taking your checkbook deposit and gambling with it and maybe losing all your money, because that's what happened in 1920, well, basically 1930 through 1932, so that when Franklin Roosevelt came into office, I mean, within a week of his coming into office, virtually every bank in the United States had failed. And the reason why was, you know, not just because of the Great Depression. They failed because these banks were making money on the side using their passbook savings and checkbook deposits from average depositors to gamble in the stock market. That was made illegal in 1935. Phil Graham blew that up with Graham Leach Bliley when he blew out Glass-Steagall in 1999, made it legal again. It had been made legal back in 1920 when Harding came into office. He made that perfectly legal. There had been laws against it up until that point that went back to the Great Depression of 1897 or 93. I forget what year it was. But, you know, the one that led to the McKinley presidency, basically. So, you know, Phil Graham makes it legal for your bank to gamble with your savings account. And guess what? You know, just like when Harding decriminalized it in 1920, 9 years later, the market crashed, or the banks crashed. Bush, or actually it was the last year of the Clinton administration, it gets decriminalized largely by Phil Graham and his Republican buddies, and 9 years later the economy crashes, and you still want the banks to use your checking account and my checking account to gamble? I don't get it.
Yeah, but that's not the case. Bear Stearns.
That is absolutely the case. Well, that is what J.P. Morgan Chase was doing.
Bear Stearns, well, let's go back a little bit. Bear Stearns is an investment bank, not a commercial bank. It has nothing to do with Glass-Steagall.
I'm not talking about Bear Stearns. I'm talking about J.P. Morgan Chase.
To do with Glass-Steagall.
Your article is about how J.P. Morgan Chase proves we don't need regulations.
Right. Merrill Lynch had nothing to do with Glass-Steagall. So I'm just saying that you're blaming the entire financial collapse on Glass-Steagall being blown out by Phil Graham. However,
yes,
almost none of the banks in the financial meltdown in 2009 had anything to do. Glass-Steagall would not have stopped any of that, correct?
No, that's wrong. Glass-Steagall would have stopped a substantial amount of that. The bigger part, actually, was the second piece of legislation that Graham got through on behalf of his wife, Wendy, who was on the board of directors of Enron. And this was at the explicit and specific request of Ken Lay. And that was, he wanted to be able to speculate in energy futures as if he was a bank. And he wanted to do it in a way that wasn't regulated by the banking regulators. So the Commodities Futures Modernization Act took a whole variety of types of gambling, of commodity gambling, out of the purview of the Commodity Futures Exchange Board, or whatever it's called, the oversight agency. And thus you went from zero unregulated derivatives in 1999 or in 2000 when this was passed. You went from zero up to somewhere between $700 and $900 trillion worth at the time of the Great Crash, and we're down to around $600 trillion worth right now, keeping in mind the GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion a year. This is still a disaster waiting to happen. But that's not what we're talking about here when we're talking about J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase lost $2 billion, and much of that money was checkbook deposits. People can open a checking account with J.P. Morgan Chase. People can have a credit card with J.P. Morgan Chase. In fact, they're one of the largest credit card issuers in the country. Do you want them gambling with your money?
If I didn't, I wouldn't give my money to J.P. Morgan. I know what J.P. Morgan does. I know they gamble my money. That's what private equity is, and that's not private equity. I'm sorry, that's what their risk taking was. They were, by the way, hedging against risk, supposedly. I mean, clearly they didn't do a very good job at it, but
they weren't hedging against risk. They were trying to make money. They were gambling. Come on, you and I both know it.
Yeah, they were
betting.
It's a gambling. I would like to see a two-tiered system where there are investment banks where I can put my money, I know what they're doing, and if they want to gamble it, they can. And commercial banks where I can put my money safely, that's insured.
Well, you're talking about bringing back Glass-Steagall. That's the exact opposite of what your article says.
No, it's not bringing back Glass-Steagall, because I don't...
That's all Glass-Steagall said was you have to declare yourself either a commercial bank and you do checking and savings and write mortgages, or an investment bank and you take people's money and you invest it in the stock market and you could charge a fee for it or you could pass it through, whatever. And it used to be that Merrill Lynch was an investment bank and Chase was a commercial bank.
Right.
And now Chase is doing both, and so is Merrill Lynch for that matter.
Well, can I ask you a question? So if a bank loses $2 billion, how would you have stopped this loss? You think Glass-Steagall would have stopped this kind of loss? I mean, you think that money isn't fungible in these large...
No, you're missing my point entirely.
Okay.
If J.P. Morgan Chase was purely an investment bank, in other words, if it was only a place where rich people put their money and said, hey, try and get me a good return on an investment, or even average, you know, working people, you know, take their $10,000 life savings and gave it to J.P. Morgan Chase. And J.P. Morgan Chase lost it all. That's one of the risks of investing. Everybody understands that. That's disclosed to everybody. $2 billion, obviously, with a bank that's got assets over $150 billion, is not going to take down the bank. But that bank is sitting on the passbook savings of millions and millions of Americans and the checking accounts of tens of millions of Americans, excuse me, the credit card accounts of tens of millions of Americans. And if they had made, instead of a $2 billion mistake, a $20 billion mistake, which is, by the way, what happened back in 2007, then, yeah, they could take down the whole financial system. And therefore, they should, since they can, they have the ability to destroy our economic commons, we have an obligation to regulate them in just enough that they can't destroy us.
You keep making it sound like there's absolutely no regulations. I mean, isn't the Justice Department looking into what J.P. Morgan did? I'm not sure what they did.
Yeah, but they have very, very limited powers, and the Republicans in Congress are doing everything they can to not fund the few powers that they have under Dodd-Frank so that they can't be implemented.
So if a bank loses $2 billion immediately, we have to say, listen, we need more regulatory control here because banks shouldn't lose $2
billion. No, it's just a good example.
They have to deal in simplistic, in the most...
No, we should have been saying this ever since 1999. That was crazy.
But we just went through all the major banks that supposedly caused this crisis, and I'm sure there's a lot more to it, obviously. Even if you put in Fannie and Freddie, they're not under Glass-Steagall either. It wouldn't have...
No, and they should be. You know, I'm with you on that. David Harsanyi, humanevents.com. You can read the article over there, unlike our friends in Washington. David Harsanyi. David, thanks for being with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is, you know, venture capital, vulture capital, Bain capital, banking. I mean,
it's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. David in Portland. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Mr. Hartman, great show. Great
you,
product you're putting out there. You and Rachel Maddow are really leading the charge. I think Chris Matthews was saying someone needs to stand up for this president and no one's doing it. And I'm saying, well, you're not, you know. Anyway, I was also talking to your guy Jacob there, and he said to make it concise, but I got a few little build-ups to my point. Could be really quick if you'll let me just go through it. In 2008, I was writing on the blogging that we need a constitutional amendment to separate cash from politics. And back in 2001, I actually published a letter to the editor 6 weeks before 9/11, predicting that there would be a terrorist attack and that it was in Manhattan. It would lead.
Okay, so we've established that you're a prophet, David. What's your prophecy?
I know that's my claim to fame. My point is that I'm sorry for the self-promotion. You were saying yesterday about every 8 years there's this pattern of war and everything. And my contribution to the conversation is I think that's a good insight, and that if we go that way, that it's going to be with all the guns and the division, this vulture capital versus, you know, the MSNBC and Fox. And all, I mean, the establishment of the Wall Street Journal, you know, the division of the rich and poor in this country. It may be that war that you're kind of saying may be in the rhythm of history may be in this country more than you know, us versus Mexico or China or something.
I sure hope we don't have another civil war, if that's what you're talking about. I don't think that that's the direction we're going. I think that the entire world is, or much of the world, is following the lead of the Republican Party with all this austerity stuff. It is killing them. They are starting to wake up from it. I mean, this was one of the things that came out of the G8 meeting this week. And you know, the rest of the world is saying thanks but no thanks. And as to whether vulture capitalism, a.k.a. private equity, a.k.a. leveraged buyouts, whether they're part of that 80-year cycle, they are, to the extent that every 80 years what we see is this financialization of America. The banksters basically rise up and run things. They did, you had the Great Bank Panic of 1857 that many historians argue brought us right to the Civil War. You had the Great Bank Panic of 1929 that arguably brought us into World War II. You have the Great Bank Panic of 2007, December 2007, that led into 2008, the last year of the Bush administration, and that, you know, arguably may lead, who knows, into a world war. I sure hope not, but I don't see it happening here. What I do see happening here is a political revolution like the one we had in 1932. I believe that that's going to happen. I think things are going to get a lot worse first, but I think that that's going to happen. David, thank you for the call. Moses in St. Anne, Illinois. Hey, Moses, what's up?
Well, I want to thank you for what you just said a minute ago. I couldn't agree with you more. I used to work for a company called Continental Can back in 1975. I think the vultures came in and did that to us. Eventually, it got sold to Crown Coal Conceal, but our pensions went right down the toilet, and the company went away to Mexico.
Yep.
So I think they've been doing it for a long time.
Oh, yeah. The first major LBO deal that was done in the United States was in 1980. So that was, you know, the year of the election that brought Ronald Reagan to power. But there have been LBO deals all the way back to the 1930s. But they really, it didn't become a really profitable industry until after 86. In 86, the Reagan equalized income tax and capital gains tax. And then after that, capital gain at 28%. And then capital gains dropped down to where it is now, 15%. And that's when being an LBO artist or a takeover artist or a private equity artist became really, really profitable. So that's where we went with that. Moses, thanks for the call. Randy in North Yarmouth, Maine. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry you caught me a little off guard there. I appreciate your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, no need to say all that. Thank you very much, though.
I'm on the banned capital thing, and one of the things that seems to be overlooked in the whole thing is the pension funds. And that's how the venture capitalists make their money.
No, that's not how venture capitalists make their money. Venture capitalists make
by putting
up the money to start businesses. That's how vulture capitalists.
Vulture capitalists.
And we need to come up with another phrase that includes private equity, because that's how private equity guys make their money, also known as LBOs. Private equity guys make their money by stripping. One of the ways that they make their money is by stripping out pensions. And Mitt Romney has destroyed lots and lots and lots of pensions in his career at Bain Capital.
And how did it educate us on how that became legal?
Well, I'm not sure that it is, but typically it involves a bank. Well, actually, it is with a bankruptcy. You've got a pension fund. There used to be laws that said that the pension fund could not be commingled with the general funds, that it had to be separated. It was locked out. Those laws got blown up, and I'm not sure exactly when. Maybe somebody in the chat room can track that down and let me know. I believe it was during the Reagan administration, but it might have even been before that. And so what happened was the government created this thing called the Federal Pension Guarantee Corporation, I believe it's called. And every company that has one of the old-fashioned pension funds had to pay a small amount into this, and in order to guarantee pensions. And when companies go bankrupt and discharge their obligations through bankruptcy, they can also, didn't used to be that they could, but now they can bankrupt their pension funds as well. So they bankrupt their pension funds, all of a sudden you're not drawing your money from the pension fund anymore, you're drawing it from the federal government's pension guarantee fund, which might pay 20 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, depending on the deal and how it was put together. So basically what's happened is these guys have bought legislation so that they can screw workers and they can screw companies and they can make off with the pension funds. And it shouldn't be. Randy, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, there's so many tangled pieces to this whole convoluted, basically financialization conspiracy that made Mitt Romney rich.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Mitt Romney would not be worth $250 million today if it wasn't for loopholes in the tax code that him and his buddies got passed.
Never stop it.
Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, and particularly banksters like Mitt Romney. Hey, wait a minute. I think I just hit something. Would rather you didn't know. Tom Hartman here with you. Banksters like Mitt Romney. Bain Capital. They're banksters. Bingo. If they're, you know, if they're in the private equity business, they're moving money around. They're banksters. You know, I've been saying for a long time the for-profit health insurance companies are in the United States are banksters. They've never given a child a vaccination. They've never looked in anybody's throat. They've never, you know, cut out a cancer. They've never cured anybody of anything. All they do is handle money. What do people do who handle money all day long? They're bank. What do you call that? What's that job category called? It's bankster. Mitt Romney is a bankster. And he's got these surrogates at Fox News. Here's clip number four. This is Fox's Stuart Varney on Fox Business News, and he's interviewing Eric Cantor. God forbid. I mean, of all people, right? The ultimate shill for the banksters. He's interviewing this weaselly little sociopath, Eric Cantor, and putting his Fox News talking points into his question. Softball question, interview technique 101, Stuart Varney on Fox so-called news.
Why would they attack capitalism? As you said, America is a free enterprise country, always has been. That is the American tradition. But capitalism seems to be attacked by the president and some people in the House.
See, it took Romney. It took the Romney campaign and Fox News, which is, of course, an extension of the Romney campaign. In fact, if you go back and you look at all the coverage of all the people who took on Romney. Roger Ailes. I mean, Roger Ailes used to work in the Nixon White House. Nixon was one of the most corrupt presidents in the history of the United States. He was mobbed up. You know, B.B. Rebozo, mafia. Richard Nixon had this guy working for him, Roger Ailes, who made some notes on a proposal that was made to the Nixon administration for something called GOP TV. I'm not making this up. GOP TV was proposed to the Nixon administration. And Roger Ailes thought it was a fine idea. He had some critiques. He had some suggestions. They played with it a little bit. Ultimately, they couldn't get anybody to back the thing. Nobody had that kind of money to start GOP TV. Fast forward a decade or so. Rupert Murdoch comes to town. Hey, mate, I got $1 billion. Which politician should I buy? Well, Mr. Murdoch, I think the Republicans would love to be bought. That's what they do for a living. Maybe even a few Democrats. Let's start this thing called GOP TV. Oh, you can't call it GOP. I do a terrible Australian accent. My apologies to our Australian listeners and viewers. You can't call it GOP TV. That's too transparent. How about Fox so-called news? Well, Mr. Murdoch, that's a good idea. Let's take the so-called out, though. But it's not going to be news. It's going to be opinion disguised as news. Well, that's still, you know, we'll pretend it's news. And so you get pretend news people like Bill O'Reilly putting out the talking points. As I started to say earlier, if you go back and you look at Fox News's coverage, and Media Matters has done a great job of compiling this, but there's other Center for American Progress, Think Progress blog. They were always with Romney. Why? Because Roger Ailes was in the Nixon administration. He understands how politics work. The rich guy wins. Right? The Mr. Clean wins. The guy, the Manchurian candidate, Mitt Romney looks like a president. Central casting, send a president. Oh, Mitt Romney. Oh, and he's worth $250 million. Of course! American people will buy this. Fox News has been supporting Mitt Romney from day one. Fox News, a.k.a. GOP TV, and they still are. Here is so-called newsman Bill O'Reilly.
I don't believe that this is a winner for President Obama to attack capitalism through Mitt Romney's performance at Bain. Wall Street Journal's all over him, and that's the most widely read newspaper in the country. It just looks like it reinforces some people's belief that the president is a socialist.
Yes, some people. Some people say, well, you know, some people are saying, right. Some people, this is the official catchphrase. Some people say that, in his spare time, Bill O'Reilly likes to eat cats. I'd say dogs, but he'd say, oh, the president does that too, right? Some people say that Bill O'Reilly actually zips on that human suit every day. He's really one of the lizard people. Some people say it. Come on. So, in any case, the talking... Here's what I find fascinating, is that it took about a week for the Republicans to get on message. These attacks by the president were getting some foothold. And not just by Obama. I mean, just by all of us, you know, and I don't mean progressives. I mean, Americans looking at what Bain Capital did and being horrified. It was a pump and dump operation. It was a strip them down operation. It was takeover. It was leveraged buyouts. That's what they were. They were LBOs. And they left a ton of wreckage in their path. And no doubt, lots of divorces and suicides and maybe even some homicides. Heaven only knows. They devastated communities. They devastated neighborhoods. They devastated families. And so Mitt Romney could have enough money that he could build a kennel to tie on the top of his roof. And for a couple of days, as the president was pointing this out, or the president's campaign was pointing this out, they didn't know how to answer it. Bain actually created some jobs over here at this steel mill. And not so good. So now they've got the surrogates. Now they bring out the attack dogs. Now they bring out Fox. Saying, hey, the president is attacking capitalism. If you attack capitalism, you must be a communist or socialist. And so, of course, when they say socialist, that's code for communist. Because Bill O'Reilly wouldn't know socialist if he bit him on the butt. In fact, Roger Ailes, day before yesterday, said, oh, John Stewart told me at a bar that he's a socialist. Right. Well, Roger, I consider myself a democratic socialist. There you go. Fox's next talking point for the politically uninformed. Because Germany is a democratic socialist state. France is a democratic socialist state. Iceland is a democratic socialist state. Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, the United Kingdom. They're actually a little more socialist than democratic socialist. I don't see these countries in trouble. You know, they're doing fine, thank you very much. In fact, Germany is, you know, you want a super socialist state? China. Well, I'm not a Chinese socialist. I'm not a fan of their form of government. But democratic socialism, where we the people have some say, yeah, okay. So the president thinks he's a socialist because he's attacking capitalism. Well, I'm actually not attacking capitalism. I've never been a capitalist. I have to tell you. I have started 7 successful businesses in my life. I arguably 8, if this radio and TV show is considered a business, which it is. I mean, we're paying a bunch of salaries and making a little bit of money and doing okay, having fun. But, you know, I've never made money off money. I've used my own money. My first business I started with my unemployment checks. My second business or third business I started with a $15,000 line of credit that American Express gave me. You know, on my American Express card. But I've never said to somebody else, okay, here's a pile of money, make us both rich. And I'm going to sit here and twiddle my thumbs and wait. That's what capitalists do. I've never done that. So I'm not a capitalist. It astounds me, people who call into this program and say, why are you attacking capitalism? I'm a capitalist. I go, oh, really? What have you invested in? Arguably, they could say, well, I've got $20,000 in the stock market in my 401k. That doesn't really make you a capitalist. That makes you an investor. And not even really an investor if you're not living off it. See, it's how you make your living. But the president isn't attacking capitalism. I'm not attacking capitalism. What I'm attacking is private equity, these vulture funds. But I just find it absolutely fascinating that the attack dogs are now out. And we will get back to your calls and thoughts on this. Every single line is slammed. I know there's a lot of you waiting on hold to, in fact, all of you waiting on hold to get through and have your say on this. My apologies for the long rant. Talk Radio News is coming up next, and we will be taking some calls, and then we'll get into it. In the third hour, we have a short debate and with Brian Doherty, and then we're going
to
continue.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Will Fox ever tell the truth about the difference between private equity and capitalism? And will the American people buy their lies in the meantime? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on?
Well, you know, there's a lot of noise in Washington, but nothing is coming yet into fruition. But there's a lot of noise right now about that IPO for Facebook and whether there should be an investigation, whether there should be congressional hearings. Nobody really knows, and neither side is saying. But of course, both committees, both the Democrat side and the Republican side, Democrat being Senate, House Republican run committees, are saying that they are really thinking about looking into it. Obviously, Justice Department is going to be looking into it. I mean, if in fact, and who knows what they really did, but if in fact they weren't above board in income, that kind of thing, these guys could go to jail for that. For billions of dollars, you're going to cheat?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the only IPO that I have ever bought into, that I've ever participated with at all, was I used to use Vonage, you know, for our phone when we lived out in Portland for our home phone, and they went public, and they made this special offer to their users, and so I think it was like $500 or something, you know. I thought, well, let's put a little bit of money into it and see what happens. I was in a gambling mood, and my recollection is that their IPO came out at $17, and within a week it had dropped to $3. And although I might be off on those numbers, but it was that kind of thing, you know. And nobody ever prosecuted anybody. Nobody ever investigated anybody because I think it was a relatively small IPO. Don't you think this is just, you know, because it's all in the headlines, everybody's looking for some way to grandstand on it?
Well, maybe. But on the other hand, what really happened there? I mean, I wouldn't have bought into that IPO. I just don't think that the revenue model is there.
Yeah. Well, especially
that kind of money. I mean, all right, maybe $1 billion, but billions and billions of dollars for Facebook? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth more than General Motors, and that, you know, it was valued at that, as valued at more than pretty much any other company in America, which is insane. And secondly, the day before the IPO, General Motors said, we're not going to advertise on Facebook anymore because we're not getting results. That should have been a huge red flag. But at that point, they had already set the IPO price. So, you know, it may be that, well, who knows? I don't pretend to be a stock analyst or.
Okay. Mr. Romney today made a talk at the Chamber of Commerce in Washington, D.C. He went after the teachers union, and most of us think that he's just trying to take a page from Chris Christie, who makes a living going after the teachers union. He said that Obama was in bed with the teachers union. Now, as you know, your friend and my friend Randy Weingarten is head of the AFT.
I was just thinking of
somehow
Randy.
I don't think that all she's interested in doing is increasing her political reach. Basically, that is what Romney accused the teachers union of doing. He said they didn't care about students. He said and again went after the unions. And he said that Obama wanted to cancel the D.C. voucher program. No hard evidence of any of that, but basically saying that Obama would get rid of it in his second term, that kind of thing.
Well, actually, I wish he would and just fund the schools appropriately, but that's a whole nother debate or discussion.
Well, that is a whole nother debate, and, you know, I don't disagree with that. But the fact is that Obama is not about to get involved in local D.C. politics. Give me a break.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Just not
Eleanor Holmes Norton is having a hard enough time.
Done by Romney. Meanwhile, Romney also he gave an interview to Time Magazine, and he basically said that the president was only a career political, a career politician, and his only experience was being a community organizer. Well, excuse me, I thought he was president of the United States for almost the last 4 years.
Yeah, there's this thing called on-the-job experience, and he's done a reasonably good job given what was handed to him and what has been going up against him. Okay, I guess they're trying to pretend then that Obama was never president.
Tom, sort of starting in on the, well, he'd be willing to make a grand bargain, but he also doesn't want the lame duck Congress deciding things as if he's already president.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, that's one way to get people to go along with things is presuppose, right? It's the old sales trick of, imagine yourself driving this car down the street. What kind of drive-in restaurant would you want to go to show off the car? Like questions like that. You know, you throw people into the expectation of the future, and it makes the future seem more real to them. The future that you're projecting. Anyhow, what else is going on?
Meanwhile, the Obama campaign today released a video montage of Gingrich and Perry going after Romney's Bain Capital stuff. So although they're accusing the Democrats and of trying to go after Bain Capital, clearly Gingrich and Perry did. And by the way, my niece is graduating from college on Saturday, and lo and behold, who is going to get an honorary degree from her college but Cory Booker?
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, I'm not convinced that Cory Booker's a bad guy. I think he was breathing the David Gregory air too much and just thought false equivalencies like, you know, the corporate media does in America all the time. Oh, the Republicans did it. The Democrats must do something just as bad. When in fact, that's not the case. That he was just buying into that. But who knows?
Okay, meanwhile, Senator Boxer has been speaking to Speaker Boehner about the transportation bill. The transportation bill is in committee. They are saying that they are coming to some common ground. So we actually may see a transportation bill coming out of Congress sometime in the not-too-distant future. I think they realize as the election comes up, it's to both sides' interest to get this done.
So are the Republicans going to try to, if they do this, fund it in such a way that the money doesn't come through until 2013 so no political benefit goes to the president? Or is it just that they know that it takes a while for any projects to take place so they can do it now?
Well, I think they know that it takes a while for projects to take place. But don't forget, transportation bill is often an equal opportunity.
Right, an opportunity for pork. Yeah.
Right.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro. Germany.info.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ron Paul, you know, everybody's talking about Mitt Romney's the last man standing. The people who are Ron Paul fans and aficionados would beg to differ with you. Brian Doherty is the senior editor at Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He's the author of the new book, Ron Paul's Revolution, The Man and the Movement He Inspired. Reason.com, of course, the website. Brian, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. So, all these young people who want to have absolutely no social safety net for themselves, You know, I don't think the average, for example, a member of my family right now has been diagnosed with leukemia, and he's going through just a brutal chemotherapy, and he's in his late 30s. He's on Social Security disability because he can't work. That is the social safety net. That's an insurance policy for people who are devastated. And Ron Paul thinks we should do away with that. And I don't understand that. It makes no sense to me. It seems excessively brutal. But anyhow, people who agree with Ron Paul on that my son-in-law should just go to hell and die, I guess, in the streets, are still gung-ho to move this Republican campaign forward, right?
Yes, they are. As I think you alluded to, there was an announcement at Paul's campaign that was misinterpreted as him dropping out. He is not dropping out. In fact, he won his second state over the weekend since that alleged dropout announcement in Minnesota. That libertarian wing, whether you agree with it or not, is definitely where the action is in the Republican Party, even though he was trounced in vote totals by Gingrich and Santorum, for example. He actually out-raised them. He raised a little bit less than the two of them combined. His activists, as people have noted, are coming out in huge numbers. They're playing the caucus game very well. And I think what you're going to see is the Paul people playing the same role within the Republican Party moving forward as the Pat Robertson people did after 1988 in his failed presidential run. You had this minority within the party. It was a religious right then. It's the libertarians now, who knew how to play the political game and really swing above their weight. And it's definitely an ongoing story. And to progressives, I think the most interesting lesson of the Paul movement, by the way, is that you can take the machinery of a major party, bring in a set of ideas that major party doesn't necessarily hang with very well, and move that party in your direction. And I think what progressives should learn most from the Paul movement is hope that there's a sort of a progressive Ron Paul who is able to do with the Democratic Party what Ron Paul did with the Republican Party, which is, be in the party but not necessarily of it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And, in fact, I've been recommending for a long time that people check out, I think it was the Concord Coalition. I could be wrong, though, but it was one of these groups that was ultimately, I think, funded by the Koch brothers that for a year or so back in 2009-2010 was aggressively telling libertarians and conservative Republicans to take over, to become precinct committee persons.
Right.
In the Republican Party, and thus and because those are the people who decide who gets to run in a primary. And so if you're going to have a primary with four Republican candidates and all four of them are libertarians, you won no matter who wins.
And that's what the Paul people are doing. Like,
that's exactly
Iowa,
right.
And Alaska state parties already run by Paul. Nevada pretty much run by Paul. Not Paul, but Paul people,
right.
Paul's fans. And, I think that there's a great lesson. The big parties are sort of these sclerotic, oversized machines, but a small, dedicated, and ideologically motivated. That's the important part. I know, Tom, that you don't agree with Paul's radical ideology, but I think it's a great example that a radical ideology energizes people in a way that sort of bland centrism, whether it be the Romney variety or the Obama variety, as I see it, way more than they can do.
And I absolutely agree, and can identify with that. I mean, when I was 13 years old, I went with my dad, who was a Republican activist at that time, although albeit an Eisenhower Republican. I went door to door with my dad for Barry Goldwater, and Barry Goldwater was our guy. He was going to stop the communists from killing us.
Yeah.
And I had read John Starmer's book, None Dare Call Us Treason, and None Dare Call It Treason, and I knew that the State Department was filled with communists, and I knew that they were coming to get us. you're 13 years old, you buy this stuff hook, line, and sinker. What I don't get is why, maybe it's because, 40 is the new 20, and maybe 30 is the new 13, because I don't get why adults would buy into this.
Well, to go back to the safety net stuff that you started with, the full actuation of Paul's libertarian vision, of course, does not have room for a federally run social safety net. But if you listen to Paul on the campaign trail a lot, which I had to do in writing my book, the way Paul is selling his vision is very much, I think, designed in ways to appeal to progressives. Because when he talks about shrinking government, he definitely says that the stuff that actually directly helps people is way down on his list. He wants to stop the wars. He wants to stop the drug wars. He wants to stop crony corporate capitalism. He wants to stop giving. Most of the things he talks about wanting to stop first are the same things that a progressive can agree with.
Well, and not just progressives. Most Americans.
Across the line, yeah.
I mean, it's not just progressives.
Like,
it's the majority of Americans.
Like taking things, health care for children or things that help the aged, like talking about cutting that stuff first is foolish. That's not what you do. So.
But just because the guy whose ultimate goal is to sell your kids heroin is giving them candy to start out with, do you really?
His goal is to allow you to not be thrown in jail for selling something people want. You know how often.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the candy.
Don't you?
That's the candy.
Don't you?
This is the, I agree.
That's
this
not
is
the candy. That's the reality.
No, that's the candy. That's the stuff that people want. What people want is, you know, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to get laid and smoke dope, and or vice versa, who want to smoke dope and get laid, and because they want to decriminalize prostitution and pot, and well, all drugs for that matter. And you know, I have no problem with. In fact, I'm an advocate of decriminalizing prostitution and pot. I think that it's absurd that they're both illegal. But and frankly, most Americans do as well, or at least pot. And I don't know that there's been any national surveys on prostitution recently. But all that said, what Ron Paul, as you correctly point out, what he's saying is stuff that not only do progressives agree with, the vast majority of Americans agree with. The vast majority of Americans think, you know, this study just came out today. 56% of Americans, are supportive of gay marriage. 58% of Americans now think pot should be decriminalized and regulated like alcohol or tobacco. I mean, it's just remarkable how these are mainstream positions. But that doesn't disguise the fact, or maybe it does for most people, but for me it doesn't, the fact that after he's done giving you the candy, the easies, the sweet stuff that everybody agrees on, he wants to sell you heroin. He wants to do, he wants to say to you that if you're 30, 35 years old and you get leukemia and you're going down in flames, you're not going to get any Social Security benefits. Sorry, you're on your own, buddy.
What Paul is pointing out is that the promises that the American government has made, it is already impossible for it to keep up.
But that's not true.
Make all these
that's a lie.
Promises. It's not a lie.
That is a bald-faced
lie. It is not a lie.
It is only not a lie if you assume that the Republicans control Congress and specifically the House of Representatives.
Assume that the rest of the world is going to keep buying our debt when it's completely clear that there's no.
Well, I know that that's been the Republican strategy is to run up all this debt. That's Republicans ran up $10 trillion in debt doing this.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that a lot of it is actually most of it is held by Americans, not foreigners. But setting all that aside, if you want, actually, we're out of time, so I'll leave you with the last word, Brian.
You can't get behind the only candidate who actually wants to do all the things you say want done because you're afraid you're going to lose these benefits that the government can't afford in the long run anyway.
Sweet, Brian. Well,
Thank you, Tom.
I think I've made my point well enough that I need not rebut that. I'll just leave you with the last word. Brian Daugherty, Reason.com, the website. Ron Paul's Revolution is the book. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, do you want Ron Paul to take away your social safety net? Just ask him.
This portion of the Tom Hartman Program is underwritten in part by Stamps.com, 1-800-Flowers.com, Carbonite.com, and EdisonFactor.com.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Steve in Rotunda, West Florida. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
It's only been an hour on the phone, but that's a small price to pay.
Thank you for waiting.
I got three really quick things.
Can you pick one, please?
Stop calling it private equity and start calling it pirate equity.
Okay.
I think that better.
Pirate equity is great. I have been looking for a term because, you know, we've got vulture capital, but that makes people think of venture capital, which actually isn't a bad thing. But private equity, how do you make that into a pejorative, calling it pirate equity? That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant, Steve. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
Next.
I thank my high school education for that.
Okay.
Next, on the legalizing marijuana,
mm-hmm.
I got a little catchphrase that I've been using for a number of years that might help turn some people around, and that is America didn't repeal prohibition because they found out that alcohol was good for you.
Well,
it was taxes.
Yeah.
that they wanted.
Well, and also there was no industry making a fortune off the crime wave that came out of Prohibition.
Right.
There was not a private prison industry at that time. The industry of companies that supplied weaponry to the police department was relatively diffuse. There were hundreds of companies that made guns and uniforms and things. It wasn't just a small conglomerate of you know, a dozen companies or so that had lobbyists. And you couldn't sell a drug test kit for whether somebody had had booze. And so now the Nixon's war on drugs, you actually have multi-billion-dollar special interest groups who stand to lose not just tens but hundreds of billions of dollars over decade-long periods if marijuana is decriminalized.
Yeah,
and
right.
and on the other hand, you've got the alcohol and tobacco industries who are both probably fighting for which one ends up with it, who stand to benefit if marijuana gets regulated like alcohol and tobacco.
Right.
We'll see how it all shakes out. But, yeah, okay. But that wasn't your question, right?
Yeah, one more thing.
Yeah.
I was wondering why the Republicans gave up on telling us that China owns the United States. So I went on factcheck.org or factcheck.com.
Right.
I'm not sure which one.
Yeah.
And I got a pie chart showing the percentages of the federal debt owned by different entities.
Right.
If you don't mind, I'll read the percentages off to you.
Sure.
Okay. OPEC owns 2%. I guess we pay for oil with treasury notes.
Well, no. Actually, we pay for oil with cash, and then they have the extra cash. They buy treasury notes. But
okay.
Got it.
The UK owns 2%.
Right.
Japan owns 6%.
Right.
The Fed owns 7%. That's the banks that own the Fed, all the small banks.
Right. They invest in treasuries.
Everybody that deals with the Fed owns the Fed.
Right.
Next is China, mainland, 8%.
Right.
All other countries, 13%. Then the U.S. public owns 29%. That's people who buy savings bonds, treasury notes, et cetera.
Right. That's like George W. Bush being born with a trust fund worth millions that was in treasuries.
Yeah. Okay. And the last one is the U.S. government. And I'm sure that this is Social Security.
Yep. Social Security
and any
is
other money they borrow
two and change trillion, 2.7 trillion.
Or whatever. Yeah. That's 32%.
Right. And that's
so
why
61% is owned by U.S. and only 8% is owned by China.
Right. Right. 51. No, 61. Yeah, you're right. 9 plus 2 is 11. Yeah, 61%.
32 and 29,
yep. 61%. And that's why when George W. Bush was first sworn in, and Jim, get this video ready, and we can play the audio through the board. That's why when George W. Bush was sworn into office, and Bill Clinton, having raised taxes on rich people by 3%, had the consequence of that was that so much revenue was coming into the federal government that we had a balanced budget and we were paying off the federal debt. And Steve, thank you very much for those stats, by the way. I appreciate the call. That's why George W. Bush went before Congress a month into his presidency and basically said he was going to continue Clinton's policies. This was before he proposed tax cuts or wars. He was going to continue Clinton's policies, and he was going to use that money to pay off the national debt. Now, this is something that Karl Rove wants you to forget was ever said. Karl Rove, and they're running these ads now about how Obama let us down, this basketball ad. Obama, he gave a great speech, but he hasn't followed through, quack, quack, quack. They want you to forget that George Bush inherited one of the biggest surpluses in history. Here it goes.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
So there's George W. Bush saying he's going to pay off all of the U.S. debt that can be retired, which would be all of the debt that's not held by the U.S. government. And keep in mind, at that point in time, you know, the federal debt was around $9 trillion. And no, actually, it had to be less than that. It was around $7 trillion. And because Bush ran up another five, which would take us to 12. So it must have been around $5.5 or $6 trillion. Yeah, if Bush added $5 trillion to it. So, but clearly that's not what he did. He didn't continue Clinton's policies. Instead, he gave us this giant tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, for Romney, you know, the Romney level rich, the super rich. And he gave us two wars put on the national credit card, paid for with money borrowed from, you know, OPEC, the UK, Japan, China, etc. Pretty incredible, actually. And the Medicare drug deal. You know, where he said, yeah, we'll pay for your drugs, but the federal government has to pay full retail. Even though they don't do that through the VA. He broke the bank.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then he crashed the economy. And now Karl Rove wants you to think it's all Obama's fault. Gee. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very latericiously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. New Jersey State Judiciary Committee. The committee unanimously voted Monday to send a bill to the full New Jersey Assembly that would decriminalize possession of up to a half ounce of marijuana. The bill will come up for a full assembly vote in the next couple of weeks. If the bill becomes law, first-time violators will be charged with civil offenses and punishments of up to $500 instead of jail time. New Jersey would become the latest state to decriminalize marijuana, joining the likes of Connecticut, California, New York, and Oregon. It's time America had a sensible drug policy, so let's hope this momentum continues. The bad. Nebraska Governor David Heineman. Recently, the cities of Omaha and Lincoln, Nebraska, passed LGBT non-discrimination ordinances, but State Attorney General John Brunning argued they were unconstitutional. Now Governor Heineman believes both of the ordinances should be put to the vote of the people. In other words, Heineman believes protection from discrimination isn't really a right, and a majority should be able to vote on whether or not they can discriminate against a minority. Sorry, Governor, some issues are too important to be voted on, and equal rights for all is one of them. And the very, very ugly, Mark Triana. Triana, a school psychologist in Louisiana, recently used his Twitter account to go on a racist rant accusing young black thugs, his phrase, of destroying America. One tweet read, "We are faced with a young black army of thugs who have declared war on the American way of life." While another read, "Young black thugs have created an atmosphere of fear throughout America. The real terrorists live among us." Triana has also publicly supported Alabama's former segregationist Governor George Wallace and has posted racially charged anti-Obama tweets as well. The fact that this man was allowed anywhere near the future generations of this country, well, that's just very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. Pirate equity. I love it. We got it. Mitt Romney is a pirate equity guy. Now, here's the one reason why I'm just a little reluctant to refer to it as pirate equity. The pirates were egalitarian. Did you know the pirate ships were democracies? That the captain was elected by the crew? You know, the movies portray them as like the captain is the biggest, baddest guy and he kicks everybody's butt. Fact of the matter is the captain was very rarely the physically most imposing member of the ship. The captain was actually the servant of everybody else. It was a job of great responsibility and great burden and not a particularly large amount of power. And when the pirates got something, they split it up equally among everybody. Even the cook got the same amount as the captain. Look it up. That's why I think the pirate party's kind of cool. You know, in Europe, there's two pirate parties that have won elections. Anyhow, Bob in Burbank. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yes, Mr. Harmon, I have a modest proposal. I'm hoping you might forward it or send it along to Senator Sanders.
Okay. I mean, I can't make any guarantees that I'll pass. I can't. Actually, I you know, I don't pass things along to Bernie. If you want to talk to him, you really need to call and talk to him.
I don't expect you to. Let me just put it to you.
Okay.
I would like to see a bill brought before the Senate that would totally deregulate the financial institutions, the large financial institutions, but would pull the FDIC insurance from them, since that was the FDIC insurance was put in there as a compromise to the original Glass-Steagall bill.
Right.
And if that were publicized, it would put the Republicans in a position that they would have to come out against free market capitalism and have to publicly support a position that would privatize all of the profits and socialize all of the losses. And
right.
I think if you could publicize that, it would be an interesting bill in the debate that ensued.
Yeah, it's kind of a variation on the libertarians and Republicans who love nuclear power, which is, you know, entirely socialized by the Price-Anderson Act. You and I are subsidizing nuclear power and all of its potential downsides 100% or a large percent, well over 90%, you know, forever, basically. The one distinction I would make, though, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't think I am, that FDIC insurance is supposed to cover deposits, checking accounts, savings accounts.
Correct.
It doesn't cover investments. So if you go to Merrill Lynch and you say, you know, here's $20,000 of my cash, turn it into 25, that's not covered by FDIC. And if they get wiped out in a market crash, you've lost your money.
Right. Well, I understand that. But what I'm saying is when you have Graham Leach Bliley,
right,
basically investment banks and savings banks are now one institution.
Right. And it used to be that FDIC only applied to commercial banks, to savings banks.
Right. So I'm saying it. But if you could not have the FDIC insurance for those large financial institutions and people understood that, it would drive the deposits to community banks and to credit unions.
I agree.
And so I think it's an interesting political gambit.
One way to do that would be to simply say any bank that has assets over $5 billion is no longer eligible for FDIC insurance.
Another great idea.
Yeah.
Either way, I think you need it as a tool to educate the public as to what's really going on.
Yeah, an excellent point. Excellent point. Bob, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. From Bob to Bob in Laguna Hills, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Oh, my God, I almost forgot my name. It's so long.
Yeah, you've been on hold for over an hour. My apologies, you and a few other
anyway,
folks.
I read your book, Screwed, and I'm going to get all the rest of them because I really enjoy what you do.
Thank you.
And I wanted to mention J.P. Morgan and their $2 billion, and you had that discussion with that guy about an hour ago. And that Morgan fired the whale that was a big trader for them in London.
Right.
And the woman that was running the whole thing, she left in disgrace. And who did they hire?
It was $14 million.
Who did they hire? They hired the guy that was the trader, a guy named Zames, Z-A-M as in Mary, E-S, from long-term capital management that
oh really that company up. Crashed didn't they
yeah they crashed badly and they crashed doing the same thing thinking that they had risk covered and there's no such thing. It's impossible to cover risk.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, now you just talked to this other fellow about the FDIC. The FDIC is guaranteeing our deposits. And they're playing with our deposits. That's
correct.
Not right.
That's correct. I agree with you. And you know, so far, we haven't seen a bank. Well, actually, we did back in 2007, 2008.
Yeah, we saw plenty of them.
Yeah, and we had to bail them out.
And then they took off the rule that you can go short, you know, and
right.
you can go short banks. They took off the rule, and immediately they put Lehman Brothers into bankruptcy.
Yes, and you know, and I'm sure a lot of Americans just got an email or a posting from their bank saying that, by the way, FDIC has temporarily been kicked up to either $250,000 or $500,000, I forget which, and it's going to drop back down to either 125 or 150 or 250, whichever it is. It's going to be cut in half. at the end of the year unless Congress acts.
You bring up so many great points that it's impossible for me to cover them, but thank you for doing it. I appreciate it. I won't take any more of your time.
Bob, thank you very much.
You understand everything that I'm talking about.
I think I get it. Thank you very much, Bob, and thanks a lot for sitting on hold there for an hour. I appreciate it. From Bob to Bob to Bob in Homeworth, Ohio. I'm going through all the people who've been on hold here for more than an hour. Bob, thank you for sitting on hold so long. What's up?
Occupied a phone.
I don't know why they're all named Bob, but
well, anyway, Tom, you was talking earlier about when they were raiding the pensions.
Yeah.
Okay, now, it was Reagan, because I recall Chicago Pacific, they come in and they bought out the Hoover Company.
Vacuum cleaner company?
Right.
Okay.
And at the time, they took $125 billion out of our pension fund in order to obtain money to buy the Hoover Company.
Whoa.
Because up until that point, pension funds had to be money put into them, and the companies couldn't touch them.
Yeah, not only the companies couldn't touch them. You know what Jimmy Hoffa was being prosecuted for in 1959 in the Sun Valley land deal, when Eisenhower and Nixon were, you know, in office in the presidency, was using the Teamster pension funds, siphoning money off of that to invest in a land deal in Florida called the Sun Valley Development, that he figured he'd make so much profit on, he'd pay it back and nobody would notice it was gone and he'd keep the profit. And he got caught, and he got caught by the Justice Department. The land deal went south. He couldn't pay back the money. The Eisenhower Justice Department went after him. He went to D.C. with $500,000 in cash and gave it to Richard Nixon in a suitcase as a bribe. And Richard Nixon got the Justice Department to drop the charges against him. And then Kennedy gets elected. And the first thing that Bobby Kennedy does when he comes in as Attorney General is he reinstates the charges against Jimmy Hoffa, which causes Jimmy Hoffa to come to Washington, D.C. with a hunting rifle looking for Bobby Kennedy. And Santos Trafficante sends a guy up to stop him, which is a whole, you know, interesting story that's in our book, Legacy of Secrecy. But the point is that, yes, back in 59 and 60, pension funds were not to be touched by anybody. And now Mitt Romney can make off with them anytime he wants. So you think the change happened during the Reagan administration?
Yeah, they used them as assets in order to obtain or, you know, be able to borrow the money.
Yeah, okay. And by the way, Jason Ben Levy says, thank you. I've been posting pirate equity here for about an hour in the chat room. Thank you, Jason. I should have noticed that before. But Bob, thank you very much for the call. Excellent point. We got to nail this stuff down. And there's so much history that's been lost, and you will not find it on Wikipedia if it reflects poorly on the conservatives who scrubbed those websites.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Do we need more hope and love in our society? Christoph thinks so. We'll talk to him in Maui right after this. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Christoph in Maui, Hawaii on the line with us. Hey, Christoph, thanks for watching Free Speech TV way out there in Hawaii. How you doing?
Pretty good. I got so much angst and my heart is beating so fast and got more questions than answers. I'm 60 years old, 30 years I lived in Deutschland, Germany, and 30 years here in Maui. Still trying to learn. I was comfortably numb for a long time. Now the sleeper has awakened, and I watch your show, and big mahalo to you.
Thank you. Mahalo
to
you, too.
On TV. It's really nice. Thank you for waking up people and coming out, and I can't believe you and Amy Goodman, you're doing so well.
Well, thank you. Hopefully there'll be more joining us, you know, as time goes on. So what did you call about, Christoph? What did you want to say?
I just want to reach out to people and give them something good to believe in. I never was a believer in prayer and God, but I think people have to concentrate on hope for our children and putting out love and trying to work together, have a common goal, and maybe government is good. So we just have to change and I'm really scared for the future of Earth, and my children have to deal with something I never was exposed to.
This particularly this global warming thing, and now they're discovering all these methane beds that are starting to open up, and methane is 18 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. There are going to be some difficult times ahead. There are difficult times right now. But we can't, I don't think that we can allow ourselves to entirely focus on the downside, because human ingenuity is extraordinary. And I'm with you, Christoph. Hope and love are very, very, very powerful forces. And, you know, you say government can be bad or good. You're absolutely right. And I think that what it does is it reflects the zeitgeist. It reflects the spirit of the times. And the spirit of the times is kind of the aggregate of what we're all thinking. I really think that there's a majoritarian kind of collective consciousness to a nation. And when that nation is frightened or angry or you know, has a bizarre leader or a group leading them, as your country experienced some 50, 60 years ago, or your birthplace experience, then things go horribly wrong. And I think that happened to us during the Bush administration. We had pathetic, frightened little men, Bush and Cheney, running this country. And they made us all frightened little people. And we came up with, and that was when, and in fact, you speak German. Jacob, pull out that Rudolf Hess quote of when he first introduced the word Heimat. This was in, when was the Nuremberg rally? Was that 38, 36, 37?
Yeah, I think 38, before they declared the world and the war. And
yes.
I wish Germany would have concentrated on the good instead of
I absolutely agree with you. But here's something that I find fascinating. This word Heimat homeland had never been used before that Nuremberg rally to describe Germany. It had always been Vaterland. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I'm quite sure I'm right. And Hitler, his whole thing was blood and earth, right? You are a German because your blood is German and you're rooted in the German soil. And here's Rudolf Hess introducing the word homeland to the German people. Just listen to this and then please translate this into English for me.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen. Heimat zu sein. Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
Now, my understanding is what he's saying there is thanks to our Führer, we have a homeland for all Germans all over the world. Do I have that right?
Oh, this is so heavy. I can't listen to that guy. I always can't. I'm the first generation with all the war. Since ever, I think. Germany and really Hawaiians and people all over the world, they fight and they kill people.
Well, the reason I bring this up is because, you know, Hitler introduced the word homeland to the German people. George W. Bush introduced the word homeland to Americans. We never used the word homeland before the second year of the Bush administration. We always referred to it as the national security of the United States.
A good one.
Yes,
it's
sir.
Earthland for all. The power is distributed one-sided, I think. People without, they cannot say what they really want, and we cannot even go more than 50 people to speak our mind. I love America. I love what it stands for. That's why I came to Maui, not for the weather and the warmness. I came here because I love free speech and freedom and liberty, being social. It's a Schimpfwort. It means it means communism, and even communism is good. Yeah. It means we common people, we people of the earth, and just please, like, let's not forget our children, and it should go on. I don't want to see something blowing up and a nuclear war. People have weapons now. It just, like, takes one big flash, and everybody is done.
Yeah.
That'd be really, really sad.
Yeah, well, I really don't think we're going down that road. And the difference, you know, Germany had Hitler, we had Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression. And I think that that was one of the things that animated the different directions we went. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we will have leadership that is compassionate and insightful as we go through these difficult times. Christoph, thank you for your call. Thanks for your words of encouragement and hope. You're absolutely right. We need hope and love in this country. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, I'll have a conversation with the Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, president of the Rainbow Push Detroit, about why Detroit is holding a funeral for democracy, and the latest on Michigan's emergency manager law. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science. Is the secret to longer life in what you're drinking in the morning? And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.